You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcasts might know Rick Britton. He's a Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer. An award-winning historian, Rick also organizes lecture programs and day trips in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On June 16, 2011, a brand new series launched entitled Historic Cemeteries of Virginia. On that evening, Sharon Hughes presented a talk on Victorian statuary symbolism and mourning customs. Hughes explained the various religious and classical concepts behind the 19th century gravestone decorations. She also gave the audience a sampling of the cemetery's many fascinating stories. Here's Sharon Hughes.
Thank you. I am the docent coordinator at the University of Virginia Art Museum, and I see a couple docents here, and they know the biggest thing I preach is flexibility. Always have a backup plan. It's not an ideal setup tonight, but we will work with it. So, I hope many of you will sign up for Monday's tour. We'll be headed down US 29. I put in a request to have weather like we've been having, and I'm sure I'll get it. So tonight I will be sharing with you some of the symbolism of gravestones found from the 19th century, as well as customs that are related to the Victorian art of mourning, and it truly was an art. I have found that cemeteries are oftentimes some of the most neglected but informative sources for historical information. The style of their headstone, the symbolism of their art, and their inscriptions often reflect religious beliefs, social class and values, and cultural change over time. However, I'd like to take a few minutes to explain how I became interested in the past, for I was one of those students that textbook history did not resonate with me. How did it connect to people like my family? And it was through my grandmother that the past came to life. I visited her every summer, and I had free rein of her house. I could look in every drawer, every nook and cranny, and I did. And I would find interesting things and bring them to her. And those objects unlocked her stories. She had letters dating back to 1836 and letters between two sisters, one in Kentucky and one in Tennessee during the Civil War. And it was her quilts made from cotton flour sacks that opened discussions of the Depression. She went to the 1939 World's Fair. And the postcard showed me optimism that people had at that time. In fact, the slogan, I think, was Dawn of a New Day. However, as we know, the war broke out, and her ration books told me what it was like at the home front. So after I had explored all of her nooks and crannies, we would always include a trip to a cemetery, usually a family cemetery. So all of these events made the past come alive, and I wanted to learn more. So we're going to fast forward to when I am the mother of two children, and I'm living in Danville, Virginia. I opened my son's textbook, and there were two sentences about the role of Danville during the Civil War.
Sharon, is that going to be too dark, or should I turn that off?
Can you turn one off, and is there a way to... I can do it. I'll manage. Okay. One about the Confederate government coming to Danville, and then the other one about a week later when it leaves Danville. There was no mention of the arsenal, which exploded, or the tobacco warehouses that housed Union soldiers, or any of the other many things like the Confederate hospitals that occurred in the town at that time. So I was the education coordinator of the Danville Museum of Fine Arts and History, and I thought this simply would not do. So I decided to use local historical sites to teach
Danville's past. And that is how I became known as the cemetery lady. And all of this paves the way for me being here tonight. So let's get to the subject at hand. In order to understand why 19th century cemetery practices had such a change from the past, we first must look briefly at what was it like in the 18th century. These photographs I took at Old City Cemetery in Hartford, Connecticut, and they're called death heads. Death was viewed as imminent, funerals were private affairs, and in the burial grounds were repositories for the deceased body. Concern was about the soul during life, not in the afterlife. These grave symbols share some of that. It's warning. People who are living, they're being warned about death. And their epitaphs tell of life's uncertainty. Let me get a drink of water here. Such as the drowning of John Sargent while he was bathing in the Connecticut River. And the epitaph says, "Of him reflect ye young and gay, and thus a solemn warning take, that though this hour you sport and play, the next to God your light may take," or one that you're probably more familiar with, "Behold, my friend, as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you must be. Prepare for death and follow me." But death was elevated to a romantic status in the 19th century. Elaborate rituals accompanied the softer, gentler view of death. And a good death was one when the dying person could dispense of blessings and advice and be surrounded by loved ones as they faded away. Death itself was not so much feared because it was considered a release from the toils here on earth. What was feared is that one would not be mourned. So as a result, mourning became publicly displayed. Victorians made sure that the deceased was still a part of their lives, and post-mortem photography was great for this because it was very effective and emotionally satisfying means to have a picture of a loved one available. Families controlled the funeral process, preparation of the body, the viewing, and the burial. The body was laid out in a room, typically the parlor, and friends and family would come to visit. And oftentimes they would stay, they pay their respects and stay through the night. This outward display of mourning varied in relation to the wealth of the family, because mourning could become quite an expensive ordeal. Doors draped in black crepe with mourning wreaths announced that death had descended on the home. Mirrors would often be covered because you did not want to see your reflection in the mirror. It might mean you would be the next one to die. And the practice of stopping clocks was also, at the time of death, was also a way to prevent bad luck. And some believed that when the body was removed from the house, it should exit feet first. You did not want the deceased person looking back and beckoning someone to come follow them into death. The mourning period involved changed behaviors for the family of the deceased. Black and somber colors were worn, sometimes lasting for several years. Behavioral restrictions during the first year of mourning, especially for women, dictated what they wore and where they went. A widow, out of respect for her spouse, avoided merriment. She remained at home except to visit close friends and to go to church. Now, a widower still had to conduct business, but he was expected to curtail his social activities. For deep mourning, that is the first year of mourning, women dressed in black, which is symbolic of spiritual darkness. As mourning progressed, clothing could be altered to include colors of gray and mauves, and additions of lace and even jewelry. Men simply wore their dark suits. Sometimes they would add an armband or a black hat band and wear gloves. Accessories for women could include black parasols, fans, and gloves, And of course, once they did wear jewelry, women liked to wear jewelry. And some of the most personal means of jewelry was having the photograph of the deceased worn on you. And that is one from my family there. And also, another tradition was to have the hair from the deceased woven into jewelry. And that is what that brooch is right there. Other customs included mourning cards and stationery. Mourning cards were used as invitations to funerals or for family members and friends long distance as kind of announcements that someone had died. And the stationery is edged in dark black. And I wanted to share just a passage from this specific mourning stationery because it was written to the family of George Whiting, who is buried in Greenhill Cemetery. It was written to his family in 1863 after George Whiting had died from infection of wounds he received at the Battle of Fredericksburg. And it reads, "The news of George's death opens a fresh wound in my own bleeding heart, and I feel that my tears could forever flow for the loved ones lost in this unholy war. By it, I have been deprived of two brothers and many friends and acquaintances. It was under these afflictions of 50 strokes that my sympathies and friendship were first drawn to your son, who was a welcome guest at my mother's house during the short sojourn of Jackson's Corps in our midst last summer after the battles of Richmond and just prior to the one at Manassas. When the army first encamped around us, he was the first to come to offer his services to spare us any undue annoyance or disturbances from the throngs of soldiers on the lawn. Our brothers were absent, and we felt truly grateful for the attention we so much needed." And it's signed by Annie Bramhan. On Monday, I'm going to share a number of stories about his colorful brother, Harry, who was also in the Civil War, but survived it for many, many years later. In the past, In the past, burial grounds were for the deceased. They were not places for the living to linger. The cultural shift that took place in the 1800s is strongly evident in the new cemeteries that were being landscaped. Most acknowledge that the Parisian cemetery, Père Lachaise, was a cemetery established in 1804 and was the leader in creating cemeteries with a garden-style landscape. And then in 1831, Mount Auburn in Massachusetts was established, leading the way to what we now call the American Rural Cemetery Movement in the United States. The movement incorporated the living and the dead. Cemeteries were located on the outskirts of town, and they were designed as parks and embellished with shrubbery, flowers, trees, walkways, and, as seen here, beautiful gazebos. Graveyards, and all of these photographs now are from Green Hill, where we were going on Monday. Graveyards soon became inhabited by families bringing picnics, taking strolls, and resting on benches in the shade. Fences or walls defined the burial plots, and family names were proudly displayed on entranceways, and boundaries were marked with beautiful cornerstones. Monuments often reflected the wealth and position of the individual or family being memorialized. Now, Victorians viewed death as the beginning of a peaceful life, one that did not involve hardships, sadness, or toil. For many, death was a religious rebirth into God's kingdom. A shift in graveyard terminology occurred. Instead of burial grounds, graveyards became cemeteries. The word cemetery is derived from the Greek word koiman, I'm not going to try to pronounce it, meaning dormitory or a place where one sleeps. The notion of sleep is evident in grave memorials that are designed to look like beds. Thus, the deceased is in heavenly sleep. Now, death, a peaceful sleep, did not just happen. Epitaphs reveal that it was brought on by the will of God, as the following epitaphs display, and I'm only going to read a couple of them. After he had served his own generation, by the will of God, fell on sleep. God's finger touched him, and he slept. Fell asleep in Jesus. Other epitaphs speak of the reward of living a good life, the manifestations of becoming an angel, a resurrected life of eternity, and the parting from this earthly world. His words were kindness, his deeds were love, his spirit humble, he rests above. The angel band was not complete. She's gone to fill the vacant seat. We love thee well, but Jesus loves thee best. Death was also viewed as an escape to a better world. Through death, one attained rest and enlightenment and life free of pain. I am not afraid to die where the weary are at rest, and there shall be no more pain. Now, the living sense of loss and mourning is also shown in epitaphs. A kind wife mourns in thee a husband lost, the poor a friend who felt what friendship cost. A precious one from us has gone, a voice we love distilled, a place is vacant in our home which never can be filled. Epitaphs also served as expressions of love for the deceased and as reminders that those left behind would one day be reunited with them in heaven. Tender mother, wife, and friends, loving hearts remember you. Little mother is in heaven waiting for us, reunited at home, waiting and longing for children. Relationships between the deceased and the living are also in epitaphs. We have an affectionate wife and devoted mother, a devoted wife and Christian worker at rest, and one that I love is wife of Decatur Jones, daughter of John Keene and Nancy Witcher, mother of 5 sons and 6 daughters. Yeah. And not unlike today, people often define their lives by their occupations, as this pastor or the politician who was a member of the Senate state of Virginia, with position he filled with distinction, and the railroad man, retired after 50 years of distinguished service with the Southern Railway. Now, during the Victorian era, symbolism hit an all-time high. Artisans were called upon to construct symbolic works of art in stone. Of the many symbols found in Green Hill Cemetery, most of them are religious in nature. In Christianity, the Holy Spirit is often depicted as a dove. Judaic menorahs and stars of David's also adorn grave markers. Other religious symbols include variations of the hand motif. A hand with the index finger pointed upward means the soul has gone to heaven. 2 hands clasped together, an earthly farewell, and a hand reaching down and plucking one of the chains from a chain means that God is bringing that link into himself. Now, a Bible, when encircled with a vine, represents eternity, the Alpha and the Omega, beginning and end, the fleur-de-lis, the Christian Trinity, and of course the cross symbolizes a church. And I don't know if you can see, but this cross is nestled by 2 ferns. And ferns are plants that usually grow in the undergrowth. They're not out in the open. So they're symbolic of humility, frankness, and sincerity. Interpretations of the torch depend on which way it is pointing. This way with the torch downward means that life has ended. However, if it was turned the other way with the flame at the top, it would represent resurrection. And you have a wreath there, which also represents eternity. Now, urns were used by the Greeks as repository for the ashes of their deceased. However, Victorians didn't use cremation very much. So they adorned the gravestones and were symbolic of the vessel that carried the soul to heaven. And angels, heavenly guardians of the deceased, are found in a variety of forms. Of course, here we have the trumpet for the call for resurrection, and on one we have the finger pointing heavenward. However, not all tombstone iconography is religious in nature. Other motifs do exist. The sundial confronts visitors with the brevity of earthly life. It is embellished with the winged hourglass and the inscribed sentiment, "Time takes all but memories." The sundial marks the passage of time. The winged hourglass indicates that life has swiftly expired. And a book, when not a Bible, depicts that the good deeds and accomplishments as having been recorded in the book of life. The choice of flowers carved into gravestones proved quite symbolic for Victorians. Easter lilies for resurrection, calla lilies for matrimony, and lily of the valley for innocence, and are often found on children's graves. This combination of lilies, roses, and daisies is a motif for innocence, beauty, and gentleness. Deceased were also metaphorically referred to by the use of the word flower, such as, "Who plucked this flower?" the gardener asked. "I," said the master, and the gardener held his peace. Another flower blooms in heaven. Sculpted trees represent life, strength, and wisdom, and for some they are representations of strong faith and virtue. There are two variations of tree tombstones, which were called stumps by their carvers. One stump was the catalog variety. They were standard. You put your name and date on it. On Monday, I'm going to show you some more personalized ones, some that are family trees that are highly decorated. Typically, a jagged edge at the top means an unexpected death. Now, many families experience the death and loss of children. I've seen a number of statistics. I've even seen one statistic say that 3 out of 5 children would not survive till their 5th birthday. So named and unnamed children are found throughout cemeteries from this time. The high mortality rate of children can be seen by the grave markers, such as the shoes of a toddler or a sleeping child, and the most prevalent symbol of innocence, a lamb. The loss of several children was not uncommon. This stone marks the gravesite of 2 children with the inscription, "Our little boys." William Edward died at 18 months in 1871. Charles Benjamin, 1 month in 1872. Let's switch to a lighter note now. Monday's trip, we will have a tour of Green Hill Cemetery, a cemetery that was established in 1863. And I will share stories of love, humor, tragedy, and greatness. And I hope that you will see how a cemetery can be a great resource for learning the history of a community. Stories I have gathered primarily through unpublished family histories, primary documents, descendant interviews, and obituaries will provide an added dimension to our tour on Monday. As way of example, let me share one story behind a very simple stone of a man who was born in the 1800s and died in the mid-1900s, Henry A. Wiseman. He was a man of high adventure. After graduating from the Danville Military Institute, he wanted to go fight in the Spanish-American War, but his parents had other plans for him, UVA Medical School. So he completed his degree in 1901 and then decided he was going to set out and see the States. He ended up in New Orleans, and while there, he signed on as a doctor for a British ship loaded with 1,000 mules. He was the doctor for the crew, not for the mules. Now, the mules were headed to South Africa for use by the British troops engaged in the Boer War. So after 2 trips, he decided to join the British troops, and he joined the Kaffrarian Rifles. And if I can point there, he is this one right over there. So he joined them. A few months later, the British lost the war, and the troops were sent to London. Wiseman was awarded the King's Medal. and he and his fellow soldiers were given a banquet in London. Some of the things that were on the menu include rock cod with egg sauce, hare, brain cutlets, and mushroom sauce. Yum. Dr. Wiseman returned to Danville and became a doctor for the mill workers at the Dan River Mills. He married Annie Laura Burton. Now, when the United States was drawn into the First World War, Wiseman wanted to fight on the front lines, so he failed to mention that he was a medical doctor. He organized Battery E of the 1st Virginia, and he is the photo in the center there. Well, of course, it didn't take long for the military to discover that he was a doctor, and he was transferred to the 113th Infantry Medical Corps. Now, he did make it to the front lines, not as a soldier, but as a doctor. And one story passed down through his family tells of Captain Wiseman ordering a German officer to pick up the end of a stretcher bearing a wounded man in order to move him from the line of action. The German officer replied that he was an officer and did not wait on other people. Dr. Wiseman responded by yanking a pistol from a guard's holster, pointing it at the German, saying, "If you don't pick up the stretcher, you'll be on the next one." He was reprimanded for this particular action, but he was also commended for his remarkable courage and devotion to duty when, with utter disregard for his personal safety, he remained in a position of great personal danger in order to care for the wounded. After the war, he returned to Danville, and he developed his medical practice. By 1933, restlessness had set in again, and he applied to Roosevelt for the position of Minister to Paraguay. Much, I'm sure, to his wife's delight, he was turned down twice. Then, when the Second World War broke out, he wanted to go off and fight. But he was 64 years of age, so he was turned down. However, he was given the position of physician for the German prisoners held in the Danville Military Institute, which was called the Castle. So, the driving force behind my grandmother's stories were quilts, letters, and others memorabilia. The gravestones of Green Hill will work the same way for me on Monday. Following this tour, we will visit the Sutherland Mansion, which is also known as the Danville Museum of Fine Arts and History, which is also known as sometimes the last White House or the last Capitol of the Confederacy, and the Langhorne House, Lady Astor's birthplace. I'd like to close with one final story. When I was growing up in Cincinnati, the public schools sent all fifth grade students to a 1 week outdoor school. I guess it was to make sure that city kids knew a little bit about nature. We were given a journal with guiding questions and statements for writing. A few years ago, after my mother's death, I found she had kept my journal. And you can imagine my laughter when I saw how I responded to "Draw something that attracted your attention today," for I had covered the whole page with gravestone images. And tucked in the back were two photographs of old gravestones. So thank you for your attention tonight, and I hope many of you will join us on Monday.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.